This is going to be one of our most fun of the year. I always like doing the first edition of the awards because you get a lot of weird small sample things. It's your first chance to really lock into on what you think is going on this season, who's really playing well among the established players, who might be ascendant, who might be on the decline. And obviously, this isn't how the year is going to end, but Danny and I put a bunch of time in to try and figure out who would win all of these awards if we had to vote on them right now. And we also got some news to get to, including more out of the Grizzlies. The buy-sell provision with Steve Kaplan and the minority owners has been activated. We don't know how much it's for yet with Per. We'll try to break that down quite a bit as well. And why don't we get started with that, Danny? John Krasinski had a piece on this. I actually, on our Dork G-Chat thread last night after we were done recording, I went back and read Zach Lowe and Brian Windhorst's piece explaining exactly how this worked. And I was wondering, hey, whatever happened with that? It was supposed to be October 2017. And what kind of an effect would that be having on this whole Fizdale firing, et cetera? And now Krasinski reporting that, in fact, that buy-sell clause has been activated. That gives the minority owners, led by Steve Kaplan, who attempted to buy the Wolves but was unable to extricate himself from the Grizzlies at that time, he basically is able to set a valuation, and either Robert Parra has to buy him out at that valuation or he gets to buy Parra out at that valuation. So really just a great game of chicken here between these two guys now.
This is like economic nerd theory into the nth degree. I'm really excited about it because, yeah, I mean, the tactics of this are incredibly complicated because you want to set, I mean, depending on what Kaplan wants, you either want to set obviously it has to be within the fair range, but where in the fair range is really complicated because of whether you want to have the team this would be a way theoretically for Kaplan to extricate himself if he didn't want to have the Grizzlies and wanted another team. And something that is in depth in John's piece for The Athletic is the idea of potentially moving the team out of there. And the problem with that, I think that was in his piece, it might have been Zach's, is that the lease is strong. It was in his piece that the lease is very strong, and there could even be a trigger in terms of trying to move the team to try to sell to local owners and things like that. So,
yeah, their lease is ironclad through 2021. And then if they do try to move after that, I think through 2017 or 2027, local owners would have some sort of an option to buy the team. Because some background here is important, and I'm paraphrasing, so apologies if I leave out exactly all this. But when Parra tried to buy the team from Michael Heisley, which had been on the market for several years, he initially wanted to come in and buy a significant portion of it himself. However, in between that agreement and the time that he actually had to fund the deal, the stock price of his company, which had gone crazy, Ubiquity, really tanked down to like $9 a share, in part due to the economy, I guess. And so he had to bring in all these other owners, Justin Timberlake, Peyton Manning, Tennessee people, and also, of course, Kaplan and Daniel Strauss is the other minority owner who is part of that buy-sell provision. And so that was our background here. Now, of course, it's a stream because Ubiquity's stock price is $66. So 7 times more than it was back when Parra was experiencing these issues. And so does he want to just get rid of Kaplan? And certainly the team, his initial investment has probably even as much as tripled as well. I think they bought it for like, you know, $350 million or so valuation back in 2012. And, you know, I have to imagine that it's worth, you know, at least $700 or $800 billion or $1 million at this point, if not more than that, given some of the recent sales. So all of that is our background here to see, you know, Steve Kaplan would apparently like to try and buy him out, Kaplan and Strauss. The question is, or get bought out themselves, because that would enable Kaplan to try and go after another team, which he hasn't been able to do since he couldn't extricate himself from this Memphis situation. I mean, the issue there, by the way, why he couldn't extricate himself was, I assume that when he tried to sell out, Parra, knowing that he really needed to get out, wasn't willing to pay him enough to where he was getting his fair share. And so that's why he had felt like, all right, I'm just going to stick around and deal with the buy sell. So it does seem like there's been some antipathy between these guys to some degree. And I'm going to be fascinated to find out what the number is going to be here.
And what I love about the prospect of, you know, you could worry about acrimony here is that the process eliminates the acrimony because you set the valuation at what you're going to set it at, and the other side makes a decision. It's not wrestling for control. It's just figuring out the value and making a business decision. So it's not that, you know, lawsuit for control or anything crazy like that. They just, you know, you figure it out in another way. And so it should be clean in that way because one side sets the value, one side determines whether that's worth it or not.
Yeah, and as Krasinski noted, and many others have as well, even Mark Gasol, their franchise center, noting that they wish that Robert Parra was around a little more. He's kind of been a bit of an absentee owner. And so does that mean that he's more inclined to cash out now? Is that all a ruse to make Kaplan put a lower valuation so Parra can then buy him out more easily? You know, and if you're Kaplan, obviously the higher you go, the more likely you are to get the team. But then, of course, you have to actually pay more money. Is he going to just put it so high that Parra just either can't afford it or has to say no? I mean, we'll see. I don't know what Parra's financial situation is. You imagine with the stock price increasing, it's all much better. So just can't wait to see how this turns out. And this all against the backdrop of a team that's not playing that well right now. And apparently, you know, I'm not sure when the deadline was to exercise this clause, but how does that fit in to what is going on? I mean, Parra certainly was consulted and may have even been the driving force behind the Fizdale firing. Is the idea that, hey, they got to start playing better so the team looks like it's not just like completely about to tank? Because that's what it looks like right now, right? They're a very unprofitable team, and it looks like they're going to be, you know, probably not going to make the playoffs this year, and it looks like things are going to be a lot worse for them over the next 4 or 5 years. So that can't help whatever the valuation ends up being.
It's a challenge, and the concerns, yeah, there has been some about the financials recently with them. You know, they've been a playoff team, and they didn't make money, and they have a lot, even with after the revenue sharing, and they still have a lot of committed money long-term, and it's money that will be hard to get out of, you know, should whoever ends up being the final owner, should that entity want to shed cap, it's actually very hard for them because it's tied up in a few players, and those players are not values probably on their contract, definitely in some cases, probably in others. So they kind of are what they are to that point, unless they want to give up further assets. But remember, Memphis already owes a first round pick with protection on it, so that extends into time unless they trade into that protection. So they can't use that to get rid of those players. They probably wouldn't want to anyway. So it's a complicated circumstance, and I highly recommend people read. I would read that piece if you are a subscriber to The Athletic, which for selfish reasons, I certainly hope that you are. And also the Low Windhorse piece from March of 2016, because they both give some of the mechanics of this and what's going on in place. And I don't know the timeline here either. I'm going to be very excited to find that out eventually.
Well, last thing here, this will just be kind of a fun game here. I'm going to take a look at their valuation in theory, and Forbes just totally eyeballs this stuff, so I'm not putting too much stock in here. $790 million valuation for the Memphis Grizzlies, 26th in the NBA, and this is a team that just, if you look at it independent of what's already there in terms of success, this is pretty close to the number 30 market in the NBA, I would say. You know, I don't, in Southern, they've done a great job of building up passion there, but, you know, compared to like a Utah or San Antonio, you know, I think that generally it's not as good of a market as those places are necessarily for basketball. It doesn't have the history that those places have, or the history of sustained success that those places have. So I would put them maybe, I mean, is there a, just if you're saying totally just evaluating the effect that the market has on the team's value, is there a worse market in the NBA than the Grizzlies?
It's hard to say so. I mean, I know that New Orleans, from what has been reported, has worse TV
New
ratings.
New Orleans is worse. New Orleans is worse.
They have worse TV ratings, and they have had an inferior team over the last few years. But yeah, I would say the Grizzlies are probably 29. And also something, because I was looking back at the Hawks price, and so the Hawks sold, Ressler bought them in 2015 for $850 million, though there has been, Forbes had an interesting piece about how that was overstated because it included some bond money, so it was really about, I think it was 730. And I think that's is the question you're going to ask to put a number on it?
Let's say you're Steve Kaplan and your goal is to buy the team. You want to get the team. But you know, you're not made of money. I mean, all these guys are made of money, but you know, you still want to make a good business deal. So the question is, how much are you bidding to try and say, all right, I'm pretty confident that Parra is going to just cash out at this price, that he's not going to match it, but that you're not going to just pay some astronomical number more than you have to.
So that's it's funny because that's a different question than what I would be considering for myself, because I would be thinking more in the 720 range. But I think that if you want to have the team, if that's your goal, then you'd be probably talking maybe more like 780, 775. And one of the big problems with Memphis is that there isn't much of a way to grow from here. You know, this isn't a circumstance where you're looking at it going, oh, well, if we did X, Y, and Z, we would be much more profitable. They've been a good team. They've been selling tickets reasonably well. So there isn't much to be actualized there. You could see this in certain ways as being a basement deal because it's low and there isn't much upward mobility.
I would go more than that than him. I would go like, you know, 900 million or so, assuming I had the money, you know, that kind of evaluation, because, or I might even go as high as to the point where I felt like he like actually like couldn't even afford to match it anymore. Now, you know, I don't know how much Para has. They probably have more
but
intel.
If you were going to do that, why
do.
Would you do that for the Grizzlies? Why not try to do an expansion team in Seattle or buy a different team? Like, I don't understand why if you're
because there's only 30 teams and the rest of these teams aren't for sale. And this is you're not in a competitive bidding process here as much as you might be elsewhere going up against people who have way more money. Now you can take That's advantage true. Of the fact that you just if you have more money than Robert Parra, he's the only guy that you have to outbid, you know, as opposed to having to outbid every other billionaire in the world who might want to buy a team. And I think the prospect of being able to move it to a better market, especially like, you know, Seattle or anywhere else, that would instantly just increase the value of your franchise. Now you have to pay a relocation fee as well. I think it's something like, you know, I don't know how much it would end up being. I forget that from.
But in their circumstance, you could argue that it would pay for itself just because they would be going from the number 29 market to presumably something in the top 10.
Yeah, if not, and there's a lot of money in Seattle too in terms of sponsors and that kind of stuff. So I don't know what the story is with like the local ones will have the option to buy the team. I mean, is that like with before it gets moved, like what is the valuation at which they would have to do that? Like I don't understand that how that would work either. But I think I would go pretty high if I were Kaplan, assuming I could afford it and assuming I wanted to own the team because of the fact that you could probably move them away. And frankly, you know, I mean, you know, the Grizzlies market, they have great fans there. They've supported the team extremely well. Like they don't deserve to have the team taken away. Now we'll see how well they support the team during this period of suckery that's going to come up here. You know, certainly more so than New Orleans, though they deserve to have a team. So this is going to be fascinating to see where it ends up, though. But my guess would be I would be extremely surprised if it's that low. Because, I mean, and for Kaplan, I mean, certainly you would bid the absolute highest price that you would be willing to pay for the team. You know, you would do that because worst case scenario, you just get bought out for more money, right? So you're picking basically the absolute highest that you would be willing to pay to own this team. And, you know, there obviously there's economic aspects of it. There are non-economic aspects of that as well. He's clearly has been wanting to be in on this. It's very important to him for some time to actually be in control. So I'm going to take the over on that.
Okay. I mean, I think the tactic here is that you want to put a value that is a little bit over what the other person you think the maximum they would be willing to pay in case there's a big disparity, which there might actually be in this case.
Yeah. Last thing on them, actually two more things. Mike Conley, actually three more things. Conley is expected back in 2 to 3 weeks. Supposedly his treatment is going well. We'll see. I think that sort of thing can be nebulous. When he starts ramping up his activity, he could start to experience soreness again. But good news at least that Chris Wallace said, no, we still have Gasol. We still have Conley. Those are good. We've got some young guys who are coming up rebuilding. Pish posh in some comments yesterday. And then Sam Amick reporting basically that Gasol and Fizdale weren't speaking for the better part of the last 10 months. There was little to no communication with them. And that he noted the Sunday night benching in Brooklyn was merely a tipping point in a situation that started to go sour quite some time ago. In Orlando, Terrence Ross suffering a sprained right medial collateral ligament and a non-displaced fracture of his right tibial plateau after he banged knees. Who was it with that he collided with yesterday? I forgot.
I think it was Russell Westbrook.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so he will be out indefinitely and miss a significant amount of time per the team. So that sounds like at least a grade 2 MCL. And this will mean that John Isaac will get more time when he actually is able to return from that sprained ankle. And Ross actually was one of the few Magic men who was not shooting well from 3-point range earlier. He's ticked up just a little bit, but he had not played up to his usual standards shooting the ball this season. So that'll mean more time for Isaac. Maybe even Hazonia will be exhumed, but probably more likely that we're just going to see some Aaron Aflalo as well, rather than Hazonia, who really just seems to be totally out of things here. All right, let's do a read, and then we'll get to what's this is going to be a long ass episode. Get to our awards after this from Stitch Fix. I've actually been working with them now for the last couple of months. What they do is they send you clothes that actually work with your style with a personalized stylist. They've actually been working with women for years, but now they're starting a men's program as well. And you've known from some of my talk that I'm a tall guy. A lot of stuff doesn't fit me that well. So that's why this has actually been such a great service for me, because I've been able to work with them. They send me stuff. If it doesn't fit me, I send it back. We are actually able to correspond. My stylist sent me a really nice note in the last package. And so we've been batting about 50% or so far, which is pretty good. And it's so easy just to send it back. They give you this bag. You just dump it in there, pull that little sticky thing, seal it, and then you give it to your mailman when he comes and takes your mail. It's all prepaid. So here's how it works with them. You go to stitchfix.com and tell them your sizes, favorite type of clothes, and most importantly, how much you want to spend too. So if you're based on what your budget is, you can control that as well. And then your personal stylist gets to work handpicking new clothes for you based on your style and budget. And if it's something that you don't like, you check out every month or however often they send you stuff, and you can comment on each piece of whether you liked it, you didn't like the pattern. Like they sent me early on, they sent me some flannel, not really a big flannel guy. So I sent that, they stopped sending me that. And they've really been doing a much better job due to our interaction and sending me some stuff that I really like. I actually wore some stuff to a game recently that Danny didn't know was from Stitch Fix, but he thought it looked awesome. And you know, Danny has the best style in the world. So again, I keep digressing here to talk about my own personal experience, how awesome it is. But you get 5 items, they deliver them right to your door. You try them on at home and you only pay for what you keep. You can get your fix monthly, quarterly. You can just go in and say, hey, I would like some stuff. There's no subscription required. The shipping is free. It's just much easier than trying to go to a store and try a bunch of stuff on. You can just kind of build your wardrobe without having to spend a bunch of time. So the way to get started with them, stitchfix.com/capspace is the URL, stitchfix.com/capspace. Easy to remember. We talk about capspace all the time in the program. You'll get 25% off when you keep all 5 items in your box. That's stitchfix.com/capspace to get started today. Let them know with that /capspace URL that you came from us. So I thought it'd be interesting before we even get started to just do our all-in. Actually, no, we'll get started. Then we get to all-NBA. We can talk about who our picks were from last year, because that's always interesting to see how things have kind of evolved since then. So
I want to start somewhere for clarification purposes for those people who are new to our award shows, and welcome. These are not doing 2 specific things, and that's not doing predictions. So this is not who we think the voters would choose if the awards were decided today, and it is not who we think will win these awards in at the end of the regular season. This is who would deserve them in our honest opinion based on what we have seen so far.
Yeah, that's a great point. And for me, if I feel there's somewhat of a subjective tie, obviously games played is going to matter, minutes played is going to matter to some degree, and then also just who I think is better and who I think has been better. You know, if you have a body of work, you know, like Aaron Gordon, for example, got some consideration for me for third team All-NBA, but part of the reason is just, you know, he's shooting such a ridiculous percentage that's so far above where he's been before. You say, all right, you know, is this really that real? You know, that's, and that's just on the margins, obviously, too. You know, you remember last year we got a lot of shit for Russ being our MVP in part due to his clutch performance, because we were like, oh, that's not repeatable, it doesn't mean anything going forward. It's like, well, that's what he did, you know. So but right on the margins, especially in the all-NBA teams as well, I think that's one that really matters a lot historically. And so I try to give a little bit less credit to aberrations than I might in some of the other categories. So anything else you want to say, or should we get started with our MVP top 3?
Let's get going. So my number one, it was interesting to go through it. First of all, we haven't really talked about this at all, either on the show or offline. And you and I talk basketball a lot, but we hadn't really gone through it. And I think part of that's just because you need to look at a lot of information to make these decisions. I obviously didn't pour through it to the same degree like when we did the MVP podcast at the end of last year. But where I settled on number number one was James Harden. And Harden dealt with a different set of circumstances through the first month and a half of the season than he will have, hopefully, for the remainder of the year, because Chris Paul is now on the floor and has been very, very good when he's been on the floor. But Harden had to shoulder a lot of the playmaking burden for this Houston Rockets team, and they are phenomenal offensively when he's been on the floor. 115 offensive rating with him on, 103.4 with him off. So they've been above water without him, but they've been elite, elite, elite with him out there. And a lot of that, while defensively, of course, it doesn't rely on him, it relies on him offensively. And so to me, that was a big part of the case for him. And he's creating a ton of shots for himself. He's creating a ton of shots for his teammates, getting to the line a lot, not as much as in prior years. And so for me, I would say I felt comfortable with him at number one.
Yeah, I think so too. If the Cavs were playing just a little bit better, I would be tempted to go with LeBron, who we believe is a superior player. I'm sure you still think that, Danny.
I do, but I also don't have LeBron second in my MVP.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's interesting. He is second for me, especially what he's been doing with this Cavs team that really has not had much else in the way of contributors creating, you know. And they're also the fact that they're now have gotten to 14-7. They're kind of more really, I mean, that's 55 win pace. They're on pace now to be like what we thought they were going to be this season. And he's 65% true shooting is just completely insane. And they've started defending better too. So I think, and especially just given how good of a player he is, you know, it would be hard for me. Harden is just, and Houston has been so good. They've been the best team in the NBA as well. And you mentioned the on-off numbers with Harden. So I would make Harden number one as a sop to how well the team is playing when he's been out there. But LeBron is certainly still been outstanding. So I'm fascinated to hear who your number two is now.
You talked about how LeBron has, and to his full credit, has done a wonderful job with a lot of uncertainty and a lack of production around him. I agree with all of that. I originally intended to have LeBron second. That was my interpretation of it. But I ended up with Giannis, even though the Bucks are barely over 500, because it's similar to Russell Westbrook to a point last year, where that team has been an absolute tire fire without him. And you could say, oh, well, you know, it's the, some of it is the roster construction and they're missing guys like Jabari Parker. Yes, that's true. But they've also had at various moments in the year, had better players in their bench than their starting lineup. So those guys are playing a lot with Giannis. So if we want to use on off, they're plus 3.3 net rating with Giannis on, negative 11.4 with him off. He has been a monster statistically. He fuels their transition offense. And like Harden, I could see this case waning because there were some elements in his, like that finishing at the rim early on and everything else, where it's toned down a little bit. But that doesn't matter to me at all at this point in the year. If the season were to end today, I would say he has provided the second most value to me. Without him on this team, the Bucks are substantially below 500.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good argument. And I just think LeBron is so clearly better than Giannis. This is a new level for Giannis here now. And 3.3 net rating with him out there is just not like that good. You know, they're just when the team itself
LeBron's
disappoints,
is plus 2.3 for the record.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. And both those guys are playing a ton of minutes as well. But this one, I had Giannis number three. And it's brutally close
between those guys. Yeah. I mean, that's another point to make here is, like I said, I felt good at number one. Giannis, LeBron, nothing there. And you're right. There were a couple other guys that I considered for, like, if this went to five, I think those last two spots would have been really, really tough. But I did feel like there was a gap between LeBron and Giannis and then guys like AD, maybe even Steph Curry and a few other guys. So I thought that there was a line of division, and Kem Pelton wrote a nice piece on the MVP and just kind of the different types of players who win. But for me, that's that in terms of impact on success, that's where the lines are right now.
Well, and also just, I think Giannis, to me, like, he can be stopped still. There are ways. Like, he still has too many weaknesses in his game. LeBron, with the way he's shooting the jump shot this year, really does not have, like, any weaknesses. I mean, he's unstoppable for just about anybody and any team. And obviously, they have a lot more shooting around him even still in this pretty stunted version of the Cavs that's around him. But yeah, so my number three was Giannis. You went with LeBron at number three then?
Oh, yeah.
And here, I actually AD up there, too, as a strong fourth, although we were only going three deep on this one. But he was my biggest competition to get into that fourth slot, potentially.
Yeah, he would be there for me as well. He's done a nice job on both ends of the four this year. And something else, as we've been tracking this with the 15 and 60, early on, there were a couple of games that influenced the sample, but they weren't doing as great with him out there and not Cousins. That has completely switched. They've been fabulous when he's been the only traditional big on, even if you're counting him as a traditional big on the floor. So yeah, I mean, Davis has had a wonderful season, and that leads pretty well into All-NBA, because one of the big definitional problems for this year is that...
Wait, can we do Defensive Player of the Year first?
If you want
to. For some reason, I had that higher in my sheet, and I have no flexibility to change, obviously, now.
Oh, right, you're now, ruining no, my actually, beautiful transition.
No, you're better. You have a better way of doing it. I'm going to move that down on the sheet right now. All will be right, and then we can do a first team All-NBA.
So the problem here is that Anthony Davis, to me, deserves to be a first-team All-NBA player. He has been one of the five best guys, but he hasn't played center that much. He's played center, is it like 26% of the time? It's something like that?
Yeah, according to Cleaning the Glass, which I believe in Ben Falk's rankings of where guys are playing more. So, because the way that you do this, Seth did this a while ago when he was back in the public domain, Seth Partno. Now the Milwaukee Bucks, if you guys don't know, our new listener who... don't listen to Dunked On Classic. We should start that channel soon. But anyway, the way you figure out what position someone is playing just based on the play-by-play data is you kind of force rank every player on the team and say, okay, if these two guys are on the floor together, who's playing a bigger position? And so I assume that's how Basketball Reference does it too, but I really find myself disagreeing with their categorizations a lot. And so Ben, I trust. Seth, I trust. So that's where we're going forward with these numbers. But AD has played center only about 26%. I really wanted to shoehorn him in as a center, as we've done before in past years. I mean, even if you were playing like 45%, but it's pretty clear. I mean, they have a real center now. They're not just like nominally starting Omer Asik or something. Like it's Cousins, and AD is playing more like a four than in past years, especially defensively. So I had to put him as a four, and I had to put him on second team. So Harden, LeBron, and Giannis, very clearly to me, I shouldn't say very clearly because AD was close to Giannis for me, but Harden, LeBron, and Giannis are the obvious ones there based on our MVP. So who are your last two slots?
The second guard, this has been a very rough year for guards. We're going to get into this in the second and third teams, and a lot of those guys I expect to be healthier moving forward. You know, if Chris Paul plays anything like what he's done so far, he can still move into an All-NBA category. But to me, the second best guard in the NBA this year so far has been Stephen Curry. He has been important for the Warriors offensively. Defensively, he's been fine. But really, point guard, you know, primary ball handler, whatever you want to say, linchpin is an offensive system. And even though he's not hitting shots at the ridiculous degree that he was, all he has to do is be better than the guys in front of him. And I think that he's done that so far.
Yeah, and Boston fans are going to be shitting themselves again over this because,
of course,
we always get the, Kyrie is... He's a better shooter than Steph. He's got better moves. He's, you know, he doesn't have the stupid turnovers, which actually, and Steph turns it over, but he actually has a low turnover rate. Kyrie's turnover rate is just incredibly small, by the way. It's like 8%. So that's impressive. But, you know, there's just, number one, Steph Curry's been way better than Kyrie Irving for a long time. Number two, the fear that Steph Curry puts into defenses as a shooter is still incredible, and he still is the second best offensive RPM in the league. And then Curry is just way better defensively than Irving is, and Irving has gotten better this year, but still, you know, he is a massive defensive liability, where Curry, you know, if you really go at him every time, yeah, you know, he's not going to be able to hold up just one-on-one against some of the best guys, but he's an excellent team defender. He executes the system, and he doesn't die on every single screen, which yes, it does matter, even though that's a meme in Boston now. So yeah, Steph Curry is still better than Kyrie. And also just, you know, look at the quality of those two offenses as well. And even if you want to look at, you know, where is Steph when all those other big stars are off the floor, where's the team offensively versus what Kyrie is doing with Boston?
The other way you can see that, and this included in this, is the Boston loss. How the Warriors have fared when Steph Curry's had foul trouble and had to sit. I mean, they've had some real bad stretches when he's been out of the game, and a lot of those have had three All-Stars on the floor. So he is central to their offense, and he is irreplaceable in that sort of a way, where Kyrie is spectacular. He's a wonderful player. We've sung his praises for years, but he isn't as essential as Curry is, and that matters.
Yeah, and Kyrie has had a wonderful season. He's been way better than I thought he would be.
He's my number three guard.
Yeah. He is at this point a no-brainer for that, I would say. Well, I wouldn't say that because Lillard has been really good too. But Curry has been still like far statistically superior in the box score stats to Kyrie this year. The team is better offensively.
It's not like Kyrie is some monster in things that aren't being quantified by the box score, especially in the regular season.
Yeah, that was going to be my last point though. So Curry, and then who is your first team All-NBA center? I have a choice that I think people would be very surprised by, but who is yours?
Joel Embiid. Embiid has been excellent defensively. I have a strange feeling that's going to come up in the near future. And he has been impactful offensively. You know, he still does have these turnover bugaboos, but he gets guys in foul trouble. And he's just been massive in that sort of a way. And when you're a center, to me, that's where the line goes. Because offense is, to me, is more important than defense just because of how you can accomplish that with personnel for every position but center. But at center, that's where it goes the other way. He has been huge defensively. And a lot of the other guys that are either in consideration or on my teams for all NBA are more offense over defense, and so that it's not necessarily that was a tiebreaker, but it was an important consideration.
Yeah, and Embiid has played 18 games, 29 minutes a game, but my number one center is LaMarcus Aldridge, and he is someone whose performance, because I'll be honest, I haven't been watching as much Spurs because with Kawhi out, it's kind of like, all right, this isn't the team that they're going to be. Am I really learning that much? Like, they aren't going to play that well against the absolute best teams. And then, you know, they kind of just Spurs to death some of the teams that aren't as good. And so I really had to look into the stats. I mean, I think he put up 40 points the other night, too. He's been playing 51% at center. Basically, whenever he plays and he's not next to Pau Gasol, he is the center on this team. He's their second biggest guy. Maybe if he's playing next to Joffrey LaVerne, who's not playing much, you might say he's the power forward again. But LaMarcus, for the first time in his career, really has been extremely efficient. He is sixth in the NBA in PER, 59% true shooting, absolutely never, ever, ever turns it over. 6.3% turnover percentage. He's been getting into the post. Remember also, he's putting up this performance with a very limited offensive supporting cast at this point. To him, if you compare the talent around Embiid offensively versus Aldridge, you know, Aldridge has clearly been the superior offensive player. And San Antonio is 14-7 without Kawhi Leonard. You know, they're playing at a 55 win pace without Kawhi Leonard, and he has been by far their best player. And that's got to start getting some recognition. And he has really, really improved defensively as well within that Spurs system. I mean, he's not Joel Embiid, but he's been a very solid defensive player in their system. You know, if he has to go against the Warriors, yeah, okay, maybe it's not great, but he is solid protecting the rim, gets on the offensive glass as well. And I've just been really, really impressed with this game. I don't expect he's going to end up here at the end, especially once Kawhi comes back, but what he's been doing has been totally lost in the narrative of, you know, he had this really bad playoffs last year when his knee was really bothering him, but expecting him to carry the offense against the Warriors without Kawhi is unrealistic. And he's playing much better this year, having gotten that extension. He's making that extension actually look like a pretty decent deal so far, if he can continue at anything like this level. And then also the last tiebreaker over Embiid, he's played three more games than Embiid, who has sat out some back-to-backs, and he plays 33 minutes a game to Embiid's 29. So that's another little tiebreaker there. Not a huge one, but enough that I think it matters. And, you know, he's also been doing this for a lot longer than Embiid has too.
Just as a clarification, I'm not disagreeing with that. I think of all NBA as more most outstanding rather than most valuable. So I do consider the value added, but it's less important for me than with MVP. So, and you might see that in some of these other ones where guys who missed a little bit of time are still in it. But I understand your rationale. I don't have too much opposition to it. I also, even though I saw, because we talked about this a little bit, that he has played a slight majority of his minutes at center, I still consider Aldridge a four, especially considering that's the way that the Spurs see him in a lot of their lineups that they put out there. So yeah, I mean, it's fine. I would have had him, if I considered him a center, I would have had him second team, not first team, but it was a tight margin for sure.
Okay, let's get to second team. Kyrie and Lillard are my guards. Kevin Durant, who has missed some time, I think he missed four of five games at one stretch, but still just a great, great player. I mean, that's a really interesting question of like whether Durant is better than Giannis. I'd still say he probably would have to be considered that. So if you're just saying who's the best player, he would be above Giannis as a forward to me. And then AD, we mentioned it as a forward, and then Embiid is my second team center. What's your roster here?
So AD, Durant, and Kyrie are all on mine. I have, you know, that those were pretty clear to me. Durant, I agree with you that Durant is a better player right now, but I do not think that he has been better than Giannis this year, and that's just because Durant's been a little bit below his standard. Giannis has been above. That happens. And I went with John Wall over Damian Lillard. The big part of that is I think their primary role is offense, and the Wizards have been better. They've been better offense overall, but they've definitely been a better offense when John Wall has been on the floor. We've even seen that in his absence the last couple of games. I think that he has provided more value there, and it's not like you could say, oh, well, John Wall's not as good defensively as he's been in the past. Guess what? He's still better than Dame. And yes, the Portland Trailblazers have a much better defense this year. They've done a nice job. I don't give Lillard much credit for that. It's between those two guys. I think Lillard has a better, you know, individual statistical profile, but I value the impact that they have on the offense, and with John Wall, that's always been a part of it for him just because he's not as gifted a scorer as Damian Lillard is.
Yeah, I think that Lillard has so little offensive talent around him. It's basically, and obviously the Wizards offense has been better than the Blazers. So, and his team has just been better. You know, the Wizards have disappointed. The Blazers have exceeded expectations, and he's basically, you know, a lot of times the only guy that they have offensively out on the floor when he plays without CJ, whereas Wall, he's got Beal next to him. Otto Porter is one of the best offensive threes, who's not just like a ball in their hands type of player. Gortat is a great role guy. He's probably about pretty similar to Nurkic. And they've also got Markieff Morris. Oubre has played well. So he's got a lot more talent around him. And Wall has also missed a couple of games here now too. So that was a tiebreaker for me as well. And in fact, I do not even have John Wall on my third team either. In part, you know, he hasn't had the most efficient season. I think his inability to make shots at the end of games is a little bit of a problem. I expect that Wall will come back to get into this. You know, if I had to say, is Wall a better player than Lillard? That's a very, I would say probably is, barely, you know, is very much just, you know, what kind of flavor do you prefer there? And he's a better player probably than the two guys I have as my third team guards, but just due to missing time and just not being quite as efficient with his own offense so far this year, that's why I didn't have him in there.
So since I didn't consider LaMarcus Aldridge a center, I had real trouble. This is going to be your third team guy, but I had real trouble with second team because they're all guys that have really high highs and but aren't complete players. And so, you know, it's DeMarcus Cousins, Al Horford, who I think has had an underappreciated year in terms of his role in Boston's success. And the guy who I ended up with second is Nikola Jokic. And the reason why I have Jokic there is just that I think Denver has taken, you know, offensively that he still brings so much of what makes them vibrant team. They're dealing with a sophomore point guard who is still learning the position in Jamal Murray, and he's been, you know, he's been all right defensively. He hasn't been great. Boogie, I would say, has been better defensively. It's a close call kind of between those two guys, but I went with Jokic.
Yeah, it's a Jokic did not make my third team. I actually had Cousins as my third team, and third team was really kind of janky. It's not going to look anything like this by the end of the year. My two guards were Kemba Walker, who actually has a plus 7.8 net rating, and per usual, they just completely fall apart whenever he's on the bench. I mean, but you look at how mediocre this Hornets team is; they're below 500, but you know they have a 7.8 net rating with him out there. It's pretty impressive. And then Klay Thompson was my other third team guard, which interestingly enough, if he somehow made third team All-NBA, which he's not going to at the end of the year, that would make him eligible for a designated player veteran extension, which would be a very, very interesting set of circumstances. But I expect him to fall out of there. But this is kind of, you know, I think he's just been a little bit better than Wall, shooting very well. He's having one of the more efficient seasons of his career to date. So, and the best defensive player of any of these guys, really, that we've been talking about for the guard position. So I went with him. I don't expect him to stay there again, just because of Wall having missed these five games. Russell Westbrook, a name that we have not mentioned at all, huge usage rate, but totally miserable efficiency. I expect Westbrook to get into this conversation by the end of the year. And then a few others in the guard position. Chris Paul obviously missed so much time. He's not eligible, but he'll be in this conversation. Kyle Lowry, quietly after a bad start to the year, is up to 63% true shooting now. So that's been incredible. He had a ton of threes last night, actually. And then Brad Beal in this conversation, CJ McCollum in this conversation a little bit. But, you know, I thought that just Thompson and Walker were the guys who stood out the most to me just in this first month. I don't expect that to continue necessarily.
I want to throw one other guy in there, and he's not somebody who is considered a two guard by ESPN's rankings, but he is playing that role with the Thunder, is Paul George. And George is not having his best offensive year. Really, yeah, really.
I think
not.
They would say that Robertson is the two there. I think George is a forward.
Okay.
Robertson guards smaller players more often than George does.
Okay. I still want to talk about him anyway, because Paul George has had he's had a very nice defensive year. I think he is an important part of what makes the Thunder work on that end. So yeah, I ended up going with Kemba as well. So mine was, because I had John Wall in the second team, so I'm pulling up my list. So I have it as Dame Lillard, you know, who you had your second team, and Kemba. But I the other reason why I kind of considered George for that spot was because, and I did not expect this, my forwards were stronger than my guards, because the other two forward spots, the one kind of no-brainer of these two was Kristaps Porzingis. Porzingis has been fabulous this year. He's just been the fifth best forward, so he gets on the third team.
No arguments there.
And then I have LaMarcus Aldridge here. If I considered him a center, he probably would have been second team. I considered him a forward, so he makes third team here. He gets that sixth spot. There are other contenders for it, but I thought he was better than all those guys. And then I ended up going with Boogie for similar logic that you had him second team. I just had him third.
Yeah, I had him over Jokic, though, as my third team center because of the defense. And the one thing that I also have different than you is there wasn't, with LaMarcus out of there, there weren't really great candidates at forward who really stuck out. I consider Kevin Love, who's having a very most efficient season of his career so far, Aaron Gordon, Blake Griffin, although he's now out and his efficiency had gone down before then. The Clippers had disappointed it as well. But I ended up going with Ben Simmons, actually, as the guy, you know, representing what the Sixers are doing. He's been a revelation. He can certainly guard that position. He is introduced as a point guard, so I think you could totally convince me that he could be a guard as well. But with nobody really overwhelming me for that last forward spot, I decided to see if I could shoehorn him in. And again, don't expect him to be in this conversation by the end of the year. I think, you know, other guys are going to step up a little bit. Although, I don't know, maybe not. And maybe, you know, you could, LaMarcus has been better than him, so certainly if you're not considering him a center, you would throw him in as well. Interesting that there's so much competition at center this year. But and it's also interesting to note that really the first position where the talent falls off is forward, and especially guys who are, you know, wing players at forward. That is the position where you can get the most value, because your replacement player is not going to be as good there.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And thank you for putting Simmons as a forward, because my feeling, as you know, is that you are the position you guard, and he guards threes and fours, so that's what he is. Offensive role is separate from that, just like it is for LeBron. But let's move on to defensive player of the year.
By the way, one more thing here. Actually, two more things. First one, Ben Falk, 89% small forward, he considers Paul George to be playing. And then...
Fine.
And we also have to do a read before we move on. And that is from Quip. I saw my sister over Thanksgiving. I told her that I was using one of her favorite phrases, which is sweater teeth, in the ads. And you don't want to get sweater teeth. Some people, if you've been brushing with a manual toothbrush, you might not even realize that you, in fact, have sweater teeth. That is that feeling of plaque around your teeth when they are not really that clean. You wake up in the morning, you can feel it. And so if you're not using an electric toothbrush yet, you're just not doing it right. It will revolutionize things. I started using one, and it's just so much better than brushing manually. You don't have to move your arm as much, which is nice for a lazy person like me, but also the vibrations just get your teeth so much cleaner. They stimulate your gums so much more. There's also a timer on there, so you'll actually like brush for the amount of time that you're supposed to, instead of just getting bored with the manual toothbrush. So that's why you should get an electric toothbrush. But the reason you should get Quip is that it's way better than all the other electric toothbrushes. No charger, no wires. It just operates off a single AAA battery for up to 3 months. They have a subscription model, so they will just send you refill packs, including new bristles, that new battery as well, the one AAA battery that lasts forever. You can take it on the road so much more easily without those chargers or wires. It's basically the size of a regular toothbrush, so I've actually got two of them. One of them just lives in my dop kit, and I take it with me whenever I travel. And I can even afford two of them because it's that perfect price point, $25. So if you have a Secret Santa at the office or something where it's like, all right, you know, I don't want to break the bank, but I actually want to get something that's good still, it's perfect. Get them equipped. You don't have to go to the store to get it either. They can ship directly to your door or to the gift recipient's door as well. Quip starts at just $25, as I mentioned. And when you go to getquip.com, that is the URL, getquip.com/capspace, you get your first refill pack free with your Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/capspace. Easier to remember because we talk about capspace all the time in the program. GETQUIP, getquip.com/capspace is your URL to get started with them. Gotten a lot of tweets from people saying, hey, I bought one of these. It's been fantastic. So I recommend that you give it a try. It's going to revolutionize your brushing, which is something that you're doing for 4 minutes a day. So it actually, having something that's better really does matter there. That 4 minutes a day adds up. All right, let's get to that defensive player of the year here.
Longtime listeners will remember that a few years ago, we struggled with how to deal with Boston. Boston was a really high level defense, but they didn't have a single player that looked like they could get defensive player of the year consideration. To me, that's the entire top five right now. Boston, Portland, OKC, Utah, San Antonio, all five of those teams are doing a wonderful job overall, but they don't really have that linchpin, that guy who's saying that's the reason. Like, I mean, with Utah, you would say, oh, it's Rudy Gobert. Gobert's missed a bunch of time, and he will continue to miss a bunch of time. So that was where I started, and I was kind of like, oh, okay, well, where am I going to go with that? But there's a team that's not in that top five, but it's not because of Joel Embiid. It is because when Joel Embiid is not on the floor, the Sixers give up a ton of points. When Joel Embiid is on the floor, they are allowing less than 100 points, well, less than 1 point per possession, and
which is basically best in the league level when he's out there.
Right, when he's out there. And so he shouldn't be punished in terms of the team level when he's there. He's been a monster at the rim. He's deterring shots
although,
a lot.
Although you could say that he should be punished because he hasn't and can't be on the floor as much.
You could make that argument. I, again, like for all NBA, I consider this not most defensive value added, but best defensive player. That's how I personally interpret the award.
So, but you don't do it that way for MVP, though. That's weird that you...
Because it's called most valuable. If it was called most valuable defender, I would do it the other way. But that's not what the award is called.
Okay. That makes sense.
And so for me, Joel Embiid has been the most impactful defensive player for the time that he has been on the floor. And he has been on the floor enough to be considered. And I think he's been fabulous there. And so in a situation where there are not as many clear-cut guys, I think we talked about this on the Twitter NBA show a little bit, Draymond is not having his best year, Kawhi Leonard has been out, Rudy Gobert has been out, he is the best option right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, you'd want to say maybe it's Horford, you'd want to say maybe it's Paul George in OKC, although if you look at some of the on-off numbers with him, they're not particularly enlightening, although, you know, that could all just be due to, as it was with Kawhi last year, some weird stuff with three-point shooting. I haven't looked at it that closely. And George has been outstanding, certainly. But yeah, I went with Embiid as well. The one stat that I will add to what you gave was team shoots 17.2% worse at the rim when he is on the court. And actually, you know, another guy I gave a little bit of consideration to was Porzingis, but overall the Knicks, even when he's been out there, haven't defended quite as well. But certainly the shooting of opponents at the rim when he is out there has been absolutely completely ridiculous. All right, I actually had, for once, a pretty clear delineation of my top three for Coach of the Year. Brad Stevens took it for me, which was a surprise, because when I was like, oh, you know what, I'm going to go with Greg Popovich, he's the best guy. But Boston has just been so good in the absence of Gordon Hayward. We always talk about how, like, young guys just aren't that good, and, like, they don't contribute to winning basketball. Well, Brad Stevens has gotten those guys to contribute to winning basketball in a way that few coaches have ever succeeded at. Who is your number one?
It's also Brad Stevens. And another part that I want to mention here is the massive turnover in their roster, that getting those guys to buy in defensively, to compete defensively into play, that it was a big coaching challenge. And also, I feel like, and it would be interesting to talk to coaches about this, that losing a talented player in season is different than losing them. I mean, granted, with Kawhi, it was always this question about when he was coming back, but losing them in the preseason, because you can kind of think about it, know what you're going to do. But 5 minutes into the season, you built your rotations, you built everything around this guy. And due to a factor that was beyond every single person's control, he's just out. And Stevens deserves a lot of credit for that. Coaches are the biggest impact they make is defensive. If you want to talk about that, individual players collectively, Boston has been the best defensive team in the league. So yeah, I would say for me, it's Stevens one, Pop two. And I'm interested because you said there was a clear top three. Who is your other guy in the top three?
I actually had someone else second and Pop third, Stan Van Gundy. Stan Van Gundy in Detroit. They yeah. are playing, I mean, they have basically the same personnel. They're, I think, 14-7. They have had some massive wins, too, against some really good teams.
Yeah, like, they're not a soft 14-7. They've beaten some legit teams.
And it seemed like, okay, you know, they're going to come back to earth a little bit. And then they've surged again recently. The bench play that he's been getting out of these guys as well has been outstanding. So I expect that he's going to fall back and that either Popovich or Stevens will be my guy at the end of the year. And Popovich is so good that I always just, you know, my tiebreaker is just who I think the best coach is. I mean, I've been Popovich and Kerr have been my top two, I think, every year that we've done this. And Golden State really not in that. I think they've underperformed their talent level so far this season. And Kerr has even said, like, hey, we're not playing that hard, you know. So when your coach is saying we're not playing that hard, it's hard to be in consideration. Although I do still think he's an excellent coach. So yeah, Stevens, Stan Van Gundy, number two, Greg Popovich, number three. Three others who deserve mention to me. Terry Stotts getting that Portland team to defend the way they are.
Absolutely.
Pretty impressive. Brett Brown, the Sixers are 12-8, a lot better than anyone thought they would be. And well, you know, a lot of that's because their rookies have been able to play more. You know, he's had to navigate this Markel Fultz thing, which was weird. And they've defended pretty well when Embiid has been out there. Just, you know, he's been, I think the ways that he has used Simmons have been creative. The fact that he's just like, hey, this guy's going to be our point guard. We're giving him the ball every single time. Get out of his way. You know, somebody could have screwed it up and be like, oh, he'll be the three and we're going to play another traditional point guard. Like, no, he's put Ben Simmons an excellent position to succeed. He's crafted an offense in which Simmons' lack of shooting, they've been able to get around that. So he's up there for me as well. And then Nate McMillan, you know, I mean, you got to talk about a lot of what they've been doing is built on crazy three-point shooting. But you know, I didn't have the Pacers two games over 500 and a lot of these guys that they had gotten, you know, in the OKC trade performing as well as they did.
You ready to move on to best surprise team and player?
Yes, our biggest surprise team and player, I think. Pretty clear in terms of team, that's the Boston Celtics after Hayward went down. Leading the East by a mile, I mean, that's obvious.
We did a podcast after the first day of the season talking about how we thought they were maybe like a low 40s win team after that, and they've been...
I don't recall saying that. No.
Well, that excuse has been working a little better recently, but let's... But then, okay, so for player, there are a lot of candidates for, because surprise is different. It's not most improved. It's not anything like that. It's who's been the most surprising. And mine is Domantas Sabonis. Sabonis, it's always hard to pick this for a guy who's going from being a rookie to a sophomore because those guys are supposed to get better. But he looks to me like a completely different basketball player. I mean, one of the stats, I threw this out on Twitter a couple days ago. He has now attempted 15 more free throws than he attempted all of last year. And he played 1,600 minutes last year. He started a lot of it at power forward for the Thunder. He played a lot more center. He's basically switched from about 85% at power forward to 85% at center, but he has looked like a completely different basketball player there, and that's a huge surprise because I didn't see that coming.
Mine was on the same team, Victor Oladipo, who we talked about. His three-point shooting is so surprising that I believe it to be unsustainable, but I mean, for him to have been in this Pacers offense in general to be a top 10 unit, I thought they would be like, you know, brushing the bottom five. And then Aaron Gordon is my other one that came to mind. I would go with Oladipo mildly over Gordon, but he's been outstanding there as well. Biggest disappointing team and player, I took me approximately 2 seconds to think of this, OKC Thunder and Russell Westbrook.
I had a lot more trouble with it because Oklahoma City, it's more about their record. I mean, in terms of their
point differential.
See,
you know, I thought that too, but their offense sucks.
Yeah, like, but I mean, but thing. Their like, defense
being
has been
20th
awesome.
In offense.
I mean, but if you're number two in defense, that's not, that's exceeding expectations to me. But
I thought they'd be a top five defense this whole time. So that's
true.
Not as much
I mean, you hyped that up as soon as they got Paul George. There is a record of that, and I understand it. But in terms of disappointment, I mean, that like, but so for me, the reason why I ended up with OKC as well is because they're really the disappointing teams this season, if you're talking about it in terms of record, are largely because of injury. You know, Memphis, the Clippers, before this recent surge, the Jazz, like those teams. Yeah, it's understandable. It's not disappointing. Yeah. It's disappointing they haven't stayed healthy, but that's a different type of thing. The other team that I considered to a point was Dallas, just because I knew they were going to miss Seth Curry, but I thought they would be a little bit more competitive. I thought their offense would be a whole hell of a lot better than 28th or 29th or wherever it is. But Oklahoma City's still there, even though I think that they're not as disappointing as you do have that. And then in terms of player, Russ is the front runner here. Two other guys that I want to mention, because for Westbrook, it is, even if you felt like we both did that last year was an aberration. admission that he wasn't that good, that he was awesome, but he wasn't that good. This is still way worse than that. Than, like, the baseline, this is way worse than the baseline, even if you were lower on the baseline than what he did last year. The other two guys I want to mention in different categories are George Hill, just because George Hill, he's been a ghost for a lot of this year. And that's, it might be the big toe. Still, to me, that's disappointing. I was a believer in George Hill. Happily, I turned on the Kings before the regular season started, but that's been disappointing. And then a part of a player is Karl Anthony Towns' defense. I mean, we both loved him going into the draft, and while the offensive ceiling was super high, we thought he had impact there. He had a wonderful defensive year next to Kevin Garnett. And so, yeah, he struggled the last couple of years. Thought he'd figure it out. He's playing next to Taj Gibson, another strong defensive four. Nope. Hasn't figured out at all.
Yeah, by the way, Russ, I mean, the reason he's up there for me, he was the MVP last year, and he wasn't really even in serious consideration for All-NBA when we're talking about it. And just so we have it, I wanted to get back to this here. My picks last year were Westbrook, Harden, Kawhi, LeBron, and AD as the center. Then second team was Steph, Isaiah Thomas, KD, Jimmy Butler, and Rudy Gobert. Butler, interestingly, how he has really not been in the conversation as well. He's not had the greatest year at forward. And then third team was Chris Paul, John Wall, Draymond Green, who, again, another guy we didn't really talk about at all as a forward this year. Giannis and Marc Gasol. So, I mean, and that was just one person's opinion. Obviously, that's not who got everything, but lots of changes so far. We'll see how many changes hold up by the end of the season. All right, let's run through some of these here quickly. Sixth man, I thought it's Tyreek Evans pretty clearly.
Oh, yeah,
at this
by
point.
A mile.
Who else did you even have in consideration briefly?
Lou Williams, Sabonis, who did most of his damage as a starter, but damn it, it still counts. Will Barton. And then Eric Gordon is like Sabonis in that he was better. I think he's been better as a starter than a sixth man, but he's still been awesome.
Yeah, Andre Iguodala was my pick last year. He has not been the same guy this year. Usually seems to start slow these days. And then three guys that are kind of a little less traditional. Kyle Kuzma, in terms of his scoring and efficiency off the bench, has been pretty impressive. And then two guys who really don't fit the archetype of the scorer off the bench. Kelly Oubre has been outstanding.
He has
for
been.
The Wizards. And then PJ Tucker, who has a 99.5 defensive rating for the season. Really a guy who I think has probably done more than anything to transform the Rockets' defensive culture.
I'm going to add that if you're going to include Kyle Kuzma, John Collins deserves consideration here too. John Collins has been an absolute monster for Atlanta, and he doesn't have the same
scoring
profile.
He's not
profile.
Playing that kind of minutes though. Like he's I don't think he's in the same category.
I disagree.
Plus he's not on the Lakers.
I also wouldn't have Kuzma on it, so that's
yeah. He's not on the Lakers. How good can he be? Dunk of the
well,
month.
Let's do rookie of the month quickly because it's Ben Simmons.
Oh yeah. Okay. Sorry. How did I skip over that?
I don't know.
Yeah, so it's Ben Simmons. Yep. So who do you have second and third?
Tatum second. He's done a nice job this year. He's executed defensively. He's done what they needed offensively. And I don't know, I didn't really think about third place too much, so I'll defer to you on that.
Yeah, I had Kuzma in third place. I mean, he's averaging like 17 points a game and he's been efficient, so I mean, like, that's for a rookie, that's completely insane. Like, he's got to be on there. Like, even if you say his defense has been bad, even if you want to say it's a fluke, even if you want to say the Lakers aren't that good, like, I mean, that's, even if you want to say he's older so he's not as good of a long-term prospect, I mean, the guy's been awesome. Like, and fourth, I'd probably have Dennis Smith. I mean, I like better as a long-term prospect than anyone in this class right now other than Simmons. I mean, if we kind of take Fultz out of it for now, just because he's been so weird. If he can get his jumper back, then it still would be Fultz for me. But Smith is, you know, he's had a huge usage and he's been really inefficient. He hasn't been as good. So I would say Tatum second, Kuzma third. For me, Smith would be on the outside looking in.
I am going to give the floor to you on Dunk of the Month because you have a passion for this, which I cannot even come close to rivaling.
Yeah, I've probably both dunked more and been dunked on way more than you have. What took it for me still, and this is one that you're going to love too, that Giannis alley-oop on Aaron Baines on the second day of the season was just one of the most ridiculous. I mean, you almost at this point have to like create a different division of like Giannis dunks and then like rest of the league dunks when you're talking about this category.
That was actually second on my list. I love that dunk. It was one that really struck me a person, especially because Baines hits him in the air, which makes it way harder to get in there. But my favorite, and so that might be the best dunk. My favorite dunk was James Johnson on Victor Oladipo, because that was just nasty. He also gets drilled on that dunk, and just the intensity, the ferocity of it. And another one that I think deserves some appreciation is there was a really nice one. I can't remember who it was against. It might have been Miami, when Wiggins had a dunk to tie a game, which was exceedingly rare to have a highlight dunk that ties a game in the final minute. I thought that was a cool one.
Yeah, it takes you back to, I remember, like, Vince Carter when he was at his apex, I think, was playing against the Rockets. This is before Olajuwon had that last cameo in Toronto. And, like, Vince just, like, blew by someone on the perimeter and, like, dunked for, like, the game-winning shot with, like, 2 seconds left. Like, no one could even turn around and, like, get over and stop him before. It was a crazy play. A few other mentions here. My number two was John Collins on Jetty Osman. He Trepuka'd him, meaning that, like, Michael Jordan, when he dunked on Kelly Trepuka, it's one of his best dunks, where he came down, did an in-and-out dribble in transition, and then went up. Trepuka tried to get up and jump with him, and then realized what was happening, and then just, like, cowered down, like, and Jordan just, like, dunked on his back. And the announcer was like, Kelly Trepuka couldn't get out of the play fast enough. Like, so I always enjoy, like, renditions of that dunk. So Collins got Osman with that, one of the few minutes that Osman has played this year. And then that Donovan Mitchell tip dunk was pretty nice. But if you're going to win this category for me, like, you got to dunk on somebody. And then Giannis also had this lefty dunk on Anthony Tolliver, where he, like, took off with the left from the dotted line. That was pretty nasty. And the last two, just to pay homage to one of the best dunkers ever, who might be wrapping it up here as a dunker pretty soon. Blake Griffin had a couple of nice ones this year. He got Rudy Gobert, and he also had a pretty nasty one on Julius Randle on opening night. But the winner is that Giannis oop on Aron Baynes at the second day of the season. Okay, what do we got next here?
Best win.
I had it as Boston over Golden State, and that was also a new category we're debuting this year, which was best game of the month. And I just thought that Boston's defense looked so good in that game. They really, really caused problems for the Warriors, made them look really uncomfortable. I mean, OKC did too, but a big part of that was Golden State just kind of throwing it all over the gym, and Kevin Durant not being himself with that ankle injury. So I thought Boston had one of the best games I've seen against Golden State defending. It was a great comeback. They out-executed the Warriors late. Their star came through, Kyrie Irving. So I thought that was really an outstanding win. And that was the best game for me as well. I thought the atmosphere in that one was great. It was a close game. The level of intensity was as high as I think it's been just about any game this season. So that game actually won two categories for me.
That was my best game, but it was not my best win. It was number two in that, to a game that we didn't cover for Dunked On, but stands out over time, which is the Toronto Raptors giving the Houston Rockets their only loss of November. We're recording this technically before the Rockets' last game in November. I think they play on Thursday night. Maybe they don't. But there are a couple different things about it. One, they beat the Rockets in Houston, and the Rockets have been a good home team. And it's not like the Rockets were, other than Chris Paul, undermanned, or that Harden had a bad game. Harden scored 38. I think Ariza had a decent game too. But the Raptors just outplayed him, and the Raptors won, and Houston has been either the best or second best team in the league. So I went with that, but the Boston game would have been second, and I think the Boston one was the best game so far.
Worst loss.
This
one. Kings franchise record loss to the Atlanta Hawks in Atlanta. They lost by like 50 points.
I have the score. 126 to 80.
Oh, man. And, you know, this Atlanta had like a worse record than them at the time, too. And I think it was Atlanta's biggest victory in franchise history. They had the biggest victory in franchise history with a team that was like 2-11 at the time it occurred. I mean, it just... such a desultory effort for the Kings in that one.
This is one that we enjoy and sometimes forget to follow up on, but it's the player that we're going to
watch. Not this year.
And the player we're going to watch. And mine is Yusuf Nurkic, because the question that I am most interested in answering in December is Portland's defense. I know you're going to talk with Mr. Murphy about it soon enough, but I want to do some of that myself too and go through it. And Nurkic is a centerpiece of that. So I want to spend some more time, quality time. And Portland has a really fun schedule in December. They play a lot of good teams, both at home and on the road, so gives me a reason to watch, which I would be watching anyway.
Yeah, mine is Mark Gasol, coach killer or not.
Congratulations on committing to watching the Grizzlies in the next month.
Yeah.
I mean, we watch everybody.
I watch every team, Danny.
We all do. And by we all, I mean the two of us and Liam.
So Mark Gasol would be my choice, especially defensively. Liam had some comments on him in the last 15 and 60. Are they going to start playing better with him on the floor? I think they had a negative -13 net rating with him on the floor during this recent losing streak prior to their loss last night. So is he still a player? Does he even have any trade value if they're talking about blowing up or not? All right, so the last thing that we'll do here is we look at team trends that will continue and that are an aberration on the monthly level. My trend that I believe will continue is that Golden State's defense will not be a top three unit. I might even extend that all the way to top five. I think their defense, whether it's the lack of competitive fire that Kerr has been talking about, or just individual players aren't looking as good, whatever it is, I don't think that they're just not competing as hard this year. Maybe they'll get it together, but I think, you know, maybe it could be top five. I don't see it being top three.
Yeah, I don't have much opposition to that, especially because they're going to be resting guys. They have five guys listed as questionable for their game against the Magic on Friday. Mine that will continue is the Philadelphia 76ers fouling a ton. They are number one in terms of most foul rate, not number one in terms of lowest foul rate. Right now, they've been bottom five in that since the 2013-14 season, so I think this will be the fifth year in a row. And with Embiid and Amir Johnson as your centers, it certainly seems like it's going to be a part of it. And they can still have a very good defense with that, but it's just something I've watched. They also, their turnover rate has not really gotten that much better, even though they have superior offensive talent now.
My trend that is an aberration, the Oklahoma City Thunder losing games. They will not be winning 40% of their games for the rest of the season. That is my prediction. But I mean, I do want to talk about them a little bit, though. We got on them in some of the most disappointing
I think it's
team.
One of the biggest stories of the month.
Oh, for sure. And while I do think they're going to play better, while I do think that their point differential is more indicative of the type of team that they are, I do think that Russell Westbrook is starting to play better and will continue to play better. The fact that they've been so bad offensively, like, that's what gives me some pause here, right? I mean, if they were just playing like, you know, the ninth ranked offense and the ninth ranked defense, I'd almost feel better about that. I mean, to be this bad offensively for an entire month with basically no injuries at all either, because, you know, what happens if one of their guys goes down? That's going to be another issue that hasn't happened yet. So that would be, that's a concern for me. I do think it's going to get better. But if you're talking about this team being, you know, a really big force in the playoffs, you know, you got it better than the 20th ranked offense, that's for sure. So even, I mean, this idea that like, oh, they're playing well enough already and, you know, it's just bad luck. Like, no, that's not true. Like, their fundamentals need to improve offensively to really get to be the type of team that they're talking about potentially being at the start of the year.
Mine is it's a simpler thing in a lot of ways, which is that Cleveland for the year so far is shooting 71.2% at the rim. And yes, they have LeBron James, but you cannot maintain that level. I think the Warriors last year were number one at like 68%. A lot of years it's been around 65%. And so it's partially that. And then I want to see what happens with Cleveland's offense as that dissipates a little bit. You know, maybe they get to the foul line a little bit more, but that is a completely unsustainable level. So I want to see what happens with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think I agree that that's unsustainable, but I think that being at the very top of the league is not. And because, I mean, look at, and when Tristan Thompson comes back, he's A, not the greatest shooter at the rim, and B, the spacing that he fails to provide is going to cause other people, his man, to make guys miss shots around the rim. But right now, I mean, they're playing Kevin Love and Channing Frye at center. I mean, there's just no, and now they're not playing Rose anymore either. There's just no help available against this team, you know, and that's why they're shooting such a great percentage. They have good finishers. LeBron, of course, you know, is driving even more than he ever has, it seems like. But, and even, you know, Derrick Rose, when he was playing before he went out with the injury, and he was playing with Thompson some too, he was shooting a great percentage at the rim after he couldn't make a shot there. So a lot of it, I think, is just systemic to how good their offense is right now.
I would agree with that. I just don't think they can keep up what they've done. So
yeah, and I'm in agreement there too. Okay, because we always agree with each other, that's a great way to end the show. Don't forget about following us on Twitter, reviewing the podcast on iTunes. That always helps us as well. We'd like to get up to 1,000 reviews. That would be pretty cool. And I think that'll do it for today. Give you a nice long one here to go into the weekend. I'd like to thank Stitch Fix for sponsoring today's program. If you're like a lot of guys, you could probably think of a million things you'd rather be doing than shopping for clothes. So Stitch Fix Men has reimagined how to find and buy clothes. You never even have to leave the house. Just go to stitchfix.com, tell them your sizes, your favorite type of clothes, and how much you want to spend. Actually, just if you're me, saying the word Stitch Fix without tripping over yourself is the hardest thing about the whole process. Everything else is super easy. Shipping is free both ways. Anything you don't want, you just send it back. You just throw it in the bag. You don't have to even worry about like taping it up or anything. They've got it all set up. Exchanges are always free too if you want a different size. You can get your fix monthly, quarterly, whenever you feel like it. No subscription required. and it's basically risk-free. You can try it out. If you don't like the stuff that they send you, just send it back and it's all free. Get started with them now at stitchfix.com/capspace and you'll get 25% off when you keep all five items in your box. That's stitchfix.com/capspace, stitchfix.com/capspace.